Backseat Producers, episode 206, The Hidden Fortress. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
We are the Backseat Producers.
Minus one.
Yeah, he's being a jerk face. I don't know. Maybe he's got to prime himself for Skanksgiving next week.
Yep, just save up the strength.
Yeah, I noticed...
Build up some reserve in his liver.
Yeah. I noticed two things of note. One, we were at Show Me's this weekend, and they are having a bikini contest. Wednesday the 23rd, Skanksgiving. Though they aren't calling it Skanksgiving, I don't.
Of course not.
I don't know why. Now, I guess
it's too obvious.
I think we're the trendsetters here because we've been celebrating. This will be our third year celebrating. But now, see, Show Me's is doing that. The Dance Club Oz, they're doing Girls Gone Wild that night.
You might want to explain to the audience. These are our local edgy nightclubs.
Well, the Oz is.
Oh, I know Oz has been around for a bloody long time. Yeah. It's more of a
dance club.
Yes, it's a dance club. It's a music venue.
Yeah, that's not like a strip club, or
right?
Anything.
We got plenty of them too.
Yeah, right next door. But
literally right next door.
The Oz
share the parking lot.
And Show Me's is basically the local version of Hooters.
Mm-hmm.
But they're having a bikini contest.
Oh,
apparently.
Yes,
so.
in the middle of November when it's about 30 degrees outside.
It's the night
best time, I know.
But it's the night before Thanksgiving. It is Skanksgiving. They're celebrating appropriately.
Yes, they are. Winding up all those people for the next day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Since they're off anyway.
Well, give them,
some of them are.
I mean, nothing goes better with like a hangover than some turkey and hanging out with family.
That's right. Since you're sleeping on the couch anyway, you might as well just make your day. You're snoozing.
You've got a headache anyway. What better to go?
Well,
with?
Yeah, you eat some turkey and have a good time. You lay on the couch and watch football. I mean, best thing a hangover cure you ever had.
So the way this is working with our time travel that we've got going here, the next episode that people will listen to, if you're listening in the feed, will be Kajimusha, which is the last of our Akira Kurosawa movies. Tonight we're talking about The Hidden Fortress. We have previously talked about...
Seven Samurai. And Yojimbo.
In fact, just released Yojimbo yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will actually play the Skanksgiving episode that we will record on Skanksgiving. We are going to play that... after we wrap up our Kurosawa movies. We actually have like a week delay, which is kind of cool. So if we end up having to miss an episode, miss a recording during the holidays or something, we shouldn't have to miss a release. We just won't have anything backlogged at that point.
We'll have to come up with a new stream to carry us through the rest of the year.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of dig doing these... these directors, doing a
epic,
focus on a director for a month. It's kind of cool to see how, the different
how they
themes and how they evolve. It was actually kind of cool doing the thing with Robin Williams, too, seeing how, as an actor, he evolved.
Right, from a television comedy actor to a serious drama actor.
Yeah.
I mean, it does shatter some of your illusions with him.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially when he played against type so much.
Yeah, going from Garp to the guy he played.
To the creepy guy in the one-hour photo.
One-hour photo, and then on to the world's greatest dad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just, it was like breakneck watching him go through those three roles.
Mm-hmm. And we're also watching again Akira Kurosawa and his growth and his changes in all his movies. If you watch them in the order in which we've been doing them, you do see him and Toshirô Mifune, his favorite actor of this era.
Right.
Both kind of grow quite a bit.
Yes. Yes.
And we're only touching on a few of his movies. He made a heck of a lot between this 8-year period.
He was prolific.
Yes.
There was a lot of movies that he made. But we're actually, by the time we're done, we're going to span something like almost 30 years of
his
career.
Right, since his first one is in 51, and his the last one we'll review came out in 85.
80. But, I mean, yeah, still, that's...
And his last movie, I think, was in 97.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow, I didn't realize he was working that late.
It was in the early 90s. Excuse me, he died in 97. His last movie was in the early 90s.
Okay. That sounds more reasonable. So tonight we're talking about Hidden Fortress.
Right. Which is a big departure from what he had been sort of doing.
Yeah. Yeah,
being this is a comedy action.
One of the liner notes I read was saying that he made this specifically to be commercial mm-hmm. and accessible.
Right.
And he did it kind of as a thank you to Toho Studios for allowing him to make his riskier, edgier movies, mm-hmm. like
Rashomon. And running over budget so much.
Well, that too. I've heard so much about Rashomon, I'm surprised we didn't end up actually putting that one on the list, but maybe we can touch on that one another time, separately.
It's kind of a whole... It's a very strange movie in itself. I mean, it broke a whole bunch of conventions, and it kind of deserves its own special feature.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe it also we can overdose on Akira Kurosawa a little too much here, too.
That's true. I think four movies from any one theme...
Is enough.
Is good. It's enough. It's enough to get a feel for it, either for an actor or for a director, for their styles. I think four is plenty.
Well, let's get into this movie now.
All right. So, what did you think, high level?
I like this movie quite a bit. I mean, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, of all of them,
acquired taste, to tell you the truth, because the humor is a little different.
Yes. Yeah. If I was gonna say personal enjoyment of the three movies I've seen so far, I'd probably put this one in second.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of middle of the road as far as my enjoyment. I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. It was a good movie. I've enjoyed all three movies, but I think it was kind of, you know, for what I've seen of Kurosawa's work, it's kind of in the middle mm-hmm. for my enjoyment. One of the things I gotta say is, I've heard a lot of people say that this is the movie that Star Wars was remade from.
Well, had inspired, I should
well,
say.
Well, I heard people specifically use the word remade.
I would say inspired. And that's a stretch to say that it was remade.
Yeah. Inspired.
I can see the elements that he picked, that George Lucas picked out.
Sure.
And some of the themes. But to say this is a remake, that's a huge stretch.
I absolutely can't agree, cannot agree with calling it a remake.
Mm-hmm.
That is ridiculous, because it's not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some themes, and there's some. Mm-hmm. I mean, and very
there's characterizations,
very
and themes.
Broad themes.
Yes,
a princess and a general traveling together,
mm-hmm. aided by two bumbling fools,
who the story is told through.
Right.
That's about
yeah.
where it starts and ends.
Mm-hmm.
Because those two bumbling fools could not be more different
mm-hmm.
from R2-D2 and C-3PO.
That's true.
I mean, they just couldn't.
No.
There is no... Except for one's taller and one's shorter.
Sure.
That's...
And,
you know
they, and they're
so
antagonistic to each other.
So is Jay and Silent Bob, mm-hmm. and so is Abbott and Costello.
Right.
So
I mean, comedy teams have been around since the beginning of,
yeah.
of theater and film.
Yeah. Tall, skinny guy, short, fat guy.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you've already got a comedy trope. Yeah,
yeah,
you've got there's comedy right there.
One's the smart one, one's the dumb one. One's the talkative one, one's the silent one. Mm-hmm. You name it. I mean.
Right. And calling it a remake, I think, is...
Well, it's a stretch.
It's ingenuine.
Well, that too.
It's it's somebody trying to pigeonhole this, mm-hmm. and what it's really trying to do is trying to...
Well, say that George Lucas rode Kurosawa's coattails.
Yeah.
No, he didn't. I mean...
You know what? He obviously had a great deal of respect for Kurosawa.
Did.
And you know what? I can see why. The man made good movies.
Mm-hmm. And he was very innovative in his film technique, too.
And you know what? So, conceptually, he used some of those ideas in storytelling. Mm-hmm. You know, pretty much any writer uses ideas in storytelling. Well, that's just the way it is.
Well, there's this way. Kurosawa used them to good effect. He didn't. He was innovative in certain elements of it. He didn't overuse them. His mm-hmm. editing was always fairly tight. There's some short stories on that, on how he did the editing, which was very unconventional for that time.
Right.
And all these conventions that he used, you know, were picked up by other filmmakers and are now considered pretty much, you know, standard film school requirements.
Yeah, I'm almost to the point where I'm tired of people saying that Lucas ripped off Kurosawa. Because mm-hmm. I've heard remade, ripoff, stuff like that. To be fair,
Kurosawa ripped off other people, too.
It always happens.
Yeah, well, he borrowed a lot from others, also.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
He just did it better.
Moving past that, mm-hmm. Acting. What did you think of the acting?
Well, Toshirô Mifune has certainly, in the time between his earlier films, has certainly changed a lot.
Yes.
His acting abilities are a lot better. He's a lot more confident in what he's doing. He's got that infectious laugh of his.
He
starts, you know, giggling like an idiot. You don't know why, but it works.
Mm-hmm.
The two supporting actors who played the two peasants. Now, they were kind of an acquired taste, to say the least. I didn't understand their humor until it kind of grows on you after a while. Initially, it's funny, then it's annoying, then it gets funny again.
Yeah, the first 10 minutes, I almost was like, I heard that this was supposed to be kind of funny. It seems... It's a very dark comedy.
Yes.
Yeah, it really is. The humor is dark, but it's solid.
Mm-hmm.
The comedy really is solid.
I think only the weakest link in this whole thing was the actress who played Princess Yuki.
Thank you. I'm glad you said that.
Not surprising, since it was her first movie and she was not a professional actress to start with.
She screamed every line.
I saw that quite a bit.
I was really hoping Adam would be here because he's got this huge, you know, Captain Anime.
Well,
hat that he wears.
Actually, I read in some of the commentaries later on is they said that was a very that technique that she used because she was likely screaming all her commands was the fact that she was trying to be. Assertive
and commanding and
overly domineering. She's an aristocrat used to getting her own way.
Yeah.
And she's a spoiled brat to boot. And of course, she was. Is one of the other actors mentioned, he says, her father raised her as a boy. So she's even more, you know, she's even more trying to overact or over dominate everybody around her. Now, that could have been just she was doing that for effect.
Yeah, either way, I kind of found it annoying.
It is. It's very annoying. Again, I'll chalk it up to some maybe just inexperience, although I kind of can't see how you'd be inexperienced around someone like Kurosawa who would probably make you act.
Right, and I think that's the problem I had
maybe
with it.
That's the way he wanted her to sound, to make her a little more... annoying,
maybe, and that's kind of what I wanted to tap. You know, someone who's got a little more anime depth,
mm-hmm.
because I wasn't sure if it was just a cultural.
I think it's partially cultural and partially it's what he's trying to push across. One of the things I've read about in sort of the history culture of Japan is. There was a huge gulf between aristocrats, the nobility, and the peasantry. I mean, almost to the point of being like one did not exist to the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, that's probably what he's trying to put, make her seem this, widen this gulf even further by making her more annoying than she probably would be. Now, I'll give her credit. Her stage presence is pretty impressive.
You know what? Scott, mm-hmm. Who does Backseat Quickies, mm-hmm. he's in the chat room, and he's talked about anime mm-hmm. a number of times on Backseat Quickies and on his own podcast. Mm-hmm. He says if we Skype him in, he can talk to okay. to that effect. So I'm going to go get an extra pair of headphones okay. for you.
All right. And we're going to pause Scott just for a second here as a technical change-up.
Hello.
Thank
What's
you.
What's going
on? Things.
No. So, have you seen the movie?
Several times, many times.
Okay. So, Fantastic. Give us the lowdown on Princess Yuki there.
All right. Yeah. So, give us the scoop.
All right. So, Princess Yuki is a shrill bitch.
Yes, we sort of surmised that.
Yeah.
Being she's a 16-year-old spoiled aristocrat, yes.
Yes, and I think in this case, Kurosawa is shooting for a character. I guess these days you'd call it a tsundere character, but in this case, it's mostly tsun and not a lot of dere.
And what is that reference? Because I'm a stupid American.
Okay, a tsundere is a certain style of. Character in Japanese fiction that starts off always female, but starts off very sort of very like hard and angry with everyone, and eventually softens up over the course of the plot.
Gotcha.
Well, that All would right. make yeah. sense since she's just had her entire kingdom and family shot out from under her, and she's hiding in a cave. She's yeah. a little angry.
Like at this point, the character like I'm trying to. Like that's the one thing I'm trying to figure out is what particular period this is supposed to be set in.
This is in the era of the Warring States era.
It's yeah, I figured it was
1500s to six. It's late 1500s, early 1600s.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so pre-Edo. Mm-hmm. Okay. But yes, in this case, you do have a lot of nobility just going to town on each other, and the peasantry just being ground under all of this.
Yeah, so. Well, yeah, and that's pretty obvious from the, you know, as the plot advances and looking at what the two peasant narrator characters are going through.
Yes, especially after they sell the horses and they're pulling the cart and says, oh, we sold the horses, now we are the horses.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, this is all played for laughs because, mm-hmm. you know, it's these two losers who... Nothing good ever happens to these guys. I love them.
Mm-hmm. No, and they
But a
are,
lot of their problems are usually self-inflicted.
And that's I think that's what's great about them is that they are the cause of all their own problems, but they're still fun to watch. They still don't take themselves all that seriously. Except for the times when they're just scared of people.
Yeah. And Mifune does a really good job of just being freaking scary. Like, there's that one scene very early in where, you know, they're running through this valley and they're scrabbling over rocks, and Mifune just always seems to appear in front of them being all,
Yeah, yeah. So, Scott, you are welcome to join us for the rest of this episode, since you clearly have knowledge. Let's
well,
go ahead
I
and
almost
take
feel
it.
Bad for doing this because I should, you know, really just slap it on my girlfriend's head, the headset on my girlfriend, considering she kind of has a degree in East Asian pop culture.
Okay.
Well, this is our lady friend Sam, right?
Yes, this is lady friend Sam.
This is the lady friend Sam.
Yes.
Not the suit, not the faux lady friend Sam that we were touting around Archon.
Yes, yes. The OG Lady Friend Sam, who's now hiding under the blankets in the hopes that I don't make her record.
Oh, no.
Make her record.
No.
Make her record.
Get her over here now.
No.
The audience demands it.
She's okay. going to sleep now.
Oh.
Okay, well, we'll have to work with both.
Well, we will have to have her on another time.
We still got one more to go.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. So, Scott... I think since you have seen it multiple times, it's fair to say that you enjoy the film.
I do enjoy the film.
What do you think of the acting as we have spoken about it so far? Because you've been in the chat room this entire time.
Well, I mean, Mifune can do anything. Like, this man... Okay, like, I didn't listen to the Seven Samurai episode yet, but I'm pretty sure... I don't think you've told the story of how he became an actor.
No. I don't think we've mentioned that at all.
No.
Okay, like, because this story just really shines just how good he is. So, Mifune was... a buddy of his got him a gig in the film lab developing film. Because he'd been a recon photographer for the Japanese Air Force during the war.
Wow.
And he's working in the photo lab. And at the end, in the late 40s and into the early 50s, Toho Studios had lost a ridiculous amount of their talent to an actor's strike.
Mm.
So in order to just to fill in their slots, because at this point the Japanese film studio system was a lot like Golden Age Hollywood in that you had...
Right, they had a constant production schedule.
Constant production, you had a stable of actors who were just signed for
contract,
you know, 5 or 10 pictures at a time with no idea what they would actually be doing.
Right, one day they might be doing a costume drama, the next day they're doing domestic comedy, next day they're doing a detective story, and so on and so on.
Yeah.
It's whatever
call
for.
So Toho has this contest to just fill in the slots, just get as many people signed to contracts and hope they get some decent people out of it. So they have an open cattle call. Anyone can submit a headshot and a resume. So his buddies in the photo lab, as a joke, submit his photo to this contest. And
that's awesome.
He decides, all right, let's go, let's play along, let's see how this works. So he goes to an audition. And I can't remember the exact movie, but he's playing a very minor role in a samurai flick. And he's asked to, just, you know, be angry. And he's like, okay, when was the last time I was angry? Oh yeah, the war. So he just sort of completely by accident stumbles on method acting.
That's awesome.
And from that day forward, he was a consummate method actor, never broke character while he was on set.
Right, and that was a hallmark of one of Kurosawa's tricks with his actors, was to keep them in costume and character all during the shooting.
Wow.
So they would, and sometimes even beforehand, there's a story that he, in this one film that he was doing on... factory workers during World War II, he actually forced his or required his actors to actually work in a factory for a week as ordinary workers, so they'd get the feel of how it does. And we hear that, you know, now, and but you know, many other actors of our, you know, the current generation have done that. The most recent one we know of is, of course, Robin Williams in a 1 Hour Photo, where he actually went to photo lab school for a week and learned to work the photo finisher machine.
Right.
At which point, you know, an English actor would sort of look at all this and say, you know, there's this thing called acting. Have you heard of it?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But it does help sometimes, you know, to help you get into the flow of the story. I mean, another big side of that is Oliver Stone, during the filming of Platoon, it had all his actors go through a shortened version of boot camp
for
a few weeks.
Well, and you know, look at some of the things that, like, Christian Bale has done to his body.
Well, that's an extreme case.
Right. So that is an awesome story.
Yeah. Like he Toshirô Mifune, I could believe him playing anything, and he's an actor. He became an actor by accident, essentially.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That is fantastic.
And it was a good career change for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no doubt, again, having some experience in the film industry, even as a film finisher, a chemist, or whatever he was called, at least he understood how movies were made.
Mm-hmm.
So he had, you know, doubt being able to watch one of the film and be next to the directors and writers, at least even in a cursory role, would give you a good feel for it.
Yep. All right. So one of the things that I liked was just how intricate the story was.
Mm-hmm.
For pretty much a straightforward, we are trying. I mean, the plot is we are trying to leave.
Mm-hmm.
We are trying to get to safety.
We got to cross the border, and we got to do it with this pile of gold.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, if you're gonna say movies are copying off of other movies, you can say Smokey and the Bandit owes one to this movie.
Yeah,
it really does.
Yes, it's a similar story. You have a truckload of golden beer trying to move across the corners and get past all the border guards, quote unquote sheriffs and Smokies, and
mm-hmm.
and of course you know there's the truck driver and the Smokey and his girlfriend and their faithful steed.
You have Bandit and mm-hmm. and
the Smokey, of course.
Well,
Jackie Gleason,
but Burt Reynolds and Sally Field, which are Mifune and the princess.
Mm-hmm.
You've got what's his name? Is it Glenn? Crap! I can't remember. The guy who drove the truck with him, mm-hmm. his buddy that has the stuttering
mm-hmm.
problem, and his dog. So that's two of them.
There you go.
Which reference the peasants that are actually doing all the work mm-hmm. because they're driving the truck. And the other two are
more or less being the foils.
They're the target.
Mm-hmm.
They're the target that is setting off and in some cases used as a decoy
mm-hmm.
to keep the Smokey off their backs.
Yeah.
So,
actually, speaking of remakes, this did get a remake.
Jerry Reed.
Recently.
Jerry Reed.
Right.
Yeah.
Was remade in 2008.
Yeah, was remade in 2008 by Shinji Higuchi.
What was this? Was
yes.
Yeah.
It's called The Hidden Fortress: The Lost Princess.
The Last Princess.
Excuse me. Yes, and it actually did fairly well too.
Was it live action?
Yes.
Was it live action? Really?
Yes, but the director had mostly worked in anime and special effects on Gamera movies.
Oh, nice. You know what? I've seen those Gamera movies because Chibi sent them to me. Those are pretty good.
Yeah.
I had fun with those.
Gamera is great, man.
Yeah. But yeah, what I really dug was the intricate plot and how all these characters had very clear motivations,
mm-hmm.
and I never felt cheated that somebody was acting outside of their motivations for just to move the story along. The peasants were always greedy;
mm-hmm.
they were always about the money. That like, never changed.
We need to get out of here, and we need to get the money with us.
Yeah, and you know what? If we are going to get out of here without the money, we're going to stop and pick up the money before we get out of here.
It's like the money was always first.
Always.
As much as they wanted to save their own skins, they wanted the money to go with it.
Yeah, because
what's the sense of skin if you don't have nice clothes for it?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, and that.
Well, how
and
could
that
they
rang
go,
true.
Well, they say it in the first part. How could we go back home with absolutely nothing? Since
right.
we sold our houses anyway.
Well, and if you look at the point there at the beginning of the film, they are working as slave laborers. What more do they have to lose?
Mm-hmm.
At this point, grab as much as you can
and
GTFO,
run.
You know? But the key there is grab as much as you can, because you know what? What's the worst that could happen? They put us back in the slave camp. Okay, we've done that before. Mm-hmm. At least we're not dead.
What's the worst they can do? Make us dig a few more graves?
Yeah. Oh, not more grave digging. and the role of the princess,
mm-hmm.
she was very clear. The role of Mifune's character, the general, his role was very clear. And then when they rescue the girl from that one town and
mm-hmm.
they buy her freedom and get her out, her motivation is absolutely clear, and you can see where she's going to go with that from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the people around her couldn't see that, you know, she was going to be all about protecting the princess.
Well, of course, she's the only one who cared about her enough to get her out.
Right, exactly.
I mean, an aristocrat actually spend money on a slave girl? Good yeah. Lord, I'm going to stick with these guys.
Yeah, and that was that scene was the one time with the princess where it was like, all right, she's not a complete bitch. I don't feel like punching her in the face anymore.
Yeah.
When she had her nice little monologue where she's like, look, you know, I know we're supposed to be getting out of here, but these are my people, and it physically hurts me to see them suffering like this. This is not right. We have to do something. No, we have to leave. No, we have to save her. I need that. I need that win.
Right. At least something to come out of this horrible thing.
That was really cool. I really liked that moment for that character.
Well, that's just it. She's watched all these people sacrifice their lives to try to save her, and she wants to kind of just reciprocate at least a little.
Right.
I mean, I'm going to save one person out of this whole mess.
Yep.
I mean, that's when her little thick skin is starting to soften up just a little bit. Because she's, again, being a nobleman, she's always lived, you know, probably a very isolated and pampered existence. And she's just now beginning to see what life is really like.
Yeah.
Because she walks into this brothel, you know, as big as day, with her rather tough guy bearing, and she's wandering around, says, gee, I've never seen a place like this. And, oh, this is what really goes on in here. And all this time, she's got her hand on her hips.
I want to buy her. How much is she? Who owns her? I want to buy her.
Yeah, and everybody, they pick up on the fact that, oh, man, she's tough.
Yeah.
And, of course, that look of hers with those eyebrows, it's like she's looking right through you.
Yeah, she looked stern.
Stern is not the word. Stone face would be better.
Yeah.
Those eyebrows just
set
her off.
So the only other thing that really spoke to me was it felt like this movie took place in a fully fleshed out world. Mm-hmm. And where you really see that, where I really saw it, was the scene when they've got the cart and the two peasants are wheeling the cart, and those guards come past and they're like, hey, have you seen these people? And basically, you can kind of see that's the inspiration for, these aren't the droids you're looking for. Really is. And that's, I mean, that was really cool. Because it was, it wasn't the same, but it was close enough.
We're looking for three men, three horses, and a girl. Have you seen them?
No. Nope. Hey.
Well,
we're three men, two girls, and a cart, so...
No horses here.
No horses.
And of course they all go riding.
And of course the peasants have to make the joke that it's like,
ah, geez.
Yeah, well, if we had horses, you think we'd be pushing?
Yeah. So then they come back.
Well, that's just it. As soon as they ride off, the first guy, you know, remarks is, well, geez, you know, they should have searched the wood. But of course they come back. We're going to search the wood.
Yeah, so then they have that conflict, and Mifune chases the
two
guys
back. Yeah, he tries
to
ride the remaining one down.
And that scene was the speeder bike chase from Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
That was, so that happened, and he gets back to town, and then he faces off against that general, and the dialogue between the two at that point, it was like, man, this world, they fleshed out this whole world and all these stories for these characters that we believe that these two generals have faced off before.
Mm-hmm. Well, they have. They said,
and that was really cool, because they're like, hey, it would have been nice to face you on the field of battle again. Yeah, it would have. And
well, why wait?
Yeah, and then they have their duel. But just that exchange was really nice, because it didn't make this insular story just about these characters that are just trying to escape.
Right.
It established that there are connections here that go way beyond just this general trying to rescue this princess. Mm-hmm.
These guys are going to have this little...
These people are famous,
mm-hmm.
and people know who they are.
Right.
It's like, I know you.
You see, when the general rides into camp, everybody gets out of his way.
Well,
especially
they kind of make some room, and then they're surrounding him, and he's kind of holding him off, and then the general from the other army comes and goes, "Oh,
you're
that's
out
so-and-so.
Of your class.
You're out of your league. Just don't even try.
Just step back. This that is was this fantastic. Is between professionals, not amateurs."
Yep.
Now this is also this fight scene between the two was a nice little technical effect too. This is where some of Kurosaga's film technique comes in, because he's jumping. Well, he's got wide shots going on. He's got multiple camera angles. Mm-hmm. You see where he's jumping from angle to angle during the fight. And this, the widescreen works good in this thing because you can. It's not the fight is open.
Yeah,
it's not closed in on the two combatants up front. It's pulled back so you can see the whole fight going on and what's happening around them. And they go to tearing up the whole camp.
What I liked was, and it's something you see in people who've are really good fighters. They don't jump right. They don't just jump right in a fight. These guys,
they spar first.
Well, they just kind of faced each other off. They just looked at each other with the spears, and you know, kind of
waited for the first guy to make the move.
They were sizing build each other up. That was fantastic.
Yeah, and the music. Again, plays into the big thing. You see the long tension of that first opening jab, and then boom, it's they kind of start going at each other faster and faster and faster, and the tempo of the music starts picking up.
Yeah, yeah. So, Scott, what do you have to? You've been quiet over there.
Okay. Well, you've just been going all out here, but in terms of
jump in, scene, haven't you ever listened to this show?
I know it's yeah, I know. Okay, but in terms of the fight scenes, yeah, Kurosawa was just a great person behind a camera, especially on these. And you know, to go back to sort of the talk of old masters is that. You know, the saying goes is that a fight between masters is either over an instant or lasts forever.
Yep.
Yep. And speaking of someone who has had experience in the martial arts, you go to a tournament and you watch all the black belts get together and spar around. There is a lot of staring going on.
Oh yeah.
Well, is that just because again they're trying to psych one or the other out, or is that just part of the ritual of the whole fight?
Oh, no. That is them looking for the openings,
okay.
Eye fakes, and just head games.
Okay. It's partially a mental game instead of just completely physical.
Yeah, I've seen, because I did a little bit of, just a very little bit of martial arts training, and one of the things that was pointed out to me early on was from the sensei who really knew what he was doing. He always looked the person in the face, and he got every tell, every read, he could telegraph where they were going by the look on their face, because they would look
to where they were going.
To where they were going. So he would watch their face. He wouldn't watch their body. He would watch their face, and it was amazing. It was incredible to watch. And if he was watching their motion, you couldn't tell. I mean, he was taking it all in. It was good. It was really cool.
Yeah, something that's kind of a signature of Kurosawa, particularly when he's shooting wide angle, is that he'll get a camera with a wide angle lens and then a very tight lens on the same thing and just flip them.
Right, he cuts.
And you see this in action in a lot of his work, where, but the fight scene's more so, because you'll have this very wide shot that immediately closes into a specific point. And that's not him switching cameras or coming in the next day with a tighter lens. That's him flicking the switch on the front of the camera on the scene.
That's cool. I was not aware of that.
Yep.
Yeah,
like, watch the dialogue scenes in the opening bit of Seven Samurai again, where you've got all the peasants looking very sad, you know, clustered together, and then you'll switch to, you know, one guy talking about how we're all doomed. That's him switching lenses.
Oh, cool. I will look for that.
Does he use that lens switch in one take? Or, well, excuse me, as part of a single take or a multiple take?
Sometimes in multiple takes, sometimes as a single.
Okay, he just literally rotates the lens on the fly, or switches or switches from a different camera view.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, he was kind of considered the first guy to make big use of that. And also, he in this movie, there's his signature wipe scenes too.
Yeah, I meant to mention that before. He used the wipe as a transition, and Lucas heavily uses the wipe as a scene transition throughout the Star Wars films, all six of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mentioned this in the chat, but something worth noting is that George mentions that that he drew a lot of inspiration from the Hidden Fortress in Star Wars, but the first draft literally was a remake. It was just this old general guy escorting this princess with these two droids in space.
Yeah.
And then three drafts later, it's this completely different thing.
Well,
because that was back when George Lucas wrote in drafts.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Instead of drafts on the fly.
Yeah.
So we've got a question in the chat room. What does that mean, the wipe?
The wipe is when you take the scene and you actually literally wipe the scene off and replace it with another. There will be a line moving through the field of view, and as it moves from one side to the other, the old scene will disappear and the new scene will replace it. Literally like turning the page on a book.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're familiar with Star Wars, they heavily use the wipe as a transition throughout.
A lot of directors will use a dissolve, which is where the scene will fade out and then transition, fade back in to a new scene.
Right.
It's considered a much gentler transition than the wipe, which is rather abrupt.
Yeah, but
And if you notice, the way Kurosawa likes to wipe is he follows motion in a scene.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right.
So he'll have a character stand up and walk to the left, and then the wipe
will follow them. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is it's a really cool stylistic thing.
Yeah, if you use it right.
Yeah, yeah, but you're right. It does kind of give the effect of turning the page in a book.
Mm-hmm. Jumping. It's better than just dissolving out and fading back.
Dissolve,
in.
Or what some of them do is where they just switch scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Where
just
it's
an
like
abrupt cut.
A very abrupt cut, which. You know, I don't mind unless it's a very dark scene and all of a sudden they go to bright daylight. And that's just annoying.
I myself don't like the abrupt cut because it seems like more like a mistaken editing.
Yeah, yeah. You can't tell. Did they mean to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
Or was that just a bad splice?
Well, a bad splice, or did they have a bad moment with the film, because I mean they can do that, you know, if the film gets caught and burned or something.
Was that effect an effect, or is that just the guy in the projection booth just missplicing the damn thing?
Exactly,
grindhouse style.
Well, that was like watching Shutter Island.
Mm-hmm.
That happened a lot, and it was I'd been watching a number of digital movies, you know, the movies on the digital projection, and then. For some reason, when I watched Shutter Island, it was not digital.
Mm-hmm.
It was standard. And I was like, oh, man, did they just have a bad cut of this film? And did they have to splice it a number of times? Because the scenes are just really jumpy. Come to find out, that's all part of the storytelling.
Mm.
Because of the nature of the narrator
right.
of the story.
His memory is jumpy.
Yeah, and it makes sense. I noticed that. And I thought it was a flaw in the film. Turns out that's actually legitimately the way they were trying to tell the story, which was kind of cool.
Yeah, and Kurosawa was sort of got really so good at some of these things that his wipe became such a signature, or his wipe effect is such a signature that he stopped using it at one point and started using the wipe effect as a transition in the film itself. Just by moving the elements around. Actually, you would sneak it in there.
Interesting.
Well, it's worth noting that Kurosawa did most of his own editing, as well as usually being on the writing team for a lot of his movies.
Right.
And his writing process was also equally hilarious and idiosyncratic.
Yes, he had his detractors who referred to him as Emperor Kurosawa.
Huh.
Well, no. What he'd do is he'd take he had four guys he would usually write with, mm-hmm. and they'd all go to a hotel somewhere in the middle of nowhere Japan, like some on top of some mountain or something. And what he'd do is they'd lock each other in. Three of them would write, and one of them was the moderator.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Like you guys write, and whenever you disagree, he decides what goes.
Yeah, and then they'd probably, again, when they got finished with the draft, one person would run it through to smooth out the writing inconsistencies.
Yeah.
That's yes, awesome. And also his editing technique was he would edit the movie as it was being produced. He would edit each scene in that day.
I know Kevin Smith does that.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Rodriguez, too.
Right, but you got to remember, this was the era before non-linear editing systems. This is doing it film by film strip by film strip, taking your daily rushes and deciding which one to use and then editing in and completing that much more of the film.
I can't imagine. I mean, with the software, it's got to be real easy for like a Robert Rodriguez or a Kevin
Smith.
Yes,
it's very easy because you can sit down there and look at the scenes simultaneously rather than looking at each scene through the moviola or in the hot box and decide, okay, do I want to use this scene or this scene, and then go and splicing it in, looking at it again, deciding, hey, don't work, let me splice that one in. I mean, Skirosaga was noted for running over budget and over time. Again, no doubt because a lot of this. But his post-production, once he was finished shooting the movie, it went to print almost immediately.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And there were a lot of movies that Toho would come to him and say, "Okay, you're really over budget, man. We're stopping production." And he'd just send off what he had finished and go fishing. And then they'd see, "Oh, he's already got this much done. All right, let's give him a little more money in a couple more weeks, and we'll see how it goes."
Let's wrap this up. We're already into this 99%.
Yeah. Because it's really easy to cancel a film when all you have are dailies.
Mm-hmm.
But he's already got some. But he's already got half a finished movie for you.
Yeah, again, a very unusual unusual directing and editing style long before, you know, these things become more or less we take for granted now.
Yeah,
he didn't have the tools to make that easy.
No, he did it really the very hard way, or at least a way that was very unusual.
Right.
By anybody's filmmaking sensibilities. But it did pay off, though.
Well, yeah.
That's why you watch this movie, everything in it just flows so nicely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the only problem I've had with his style, and again, it may be a cultural thing, it may be his style, I'm not real sure. There are a couple of points where there are scenes that go on
too long,
a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the sequences, like with the peasants trying to get up the
right, the hill, climb the hill,
climb the hill. It was like, oh God, we could have cut this in half. I understand the point you're getting at,
mm-hmm.
but dear God, please, we can cut 30 seconds out of this film just like that.
Mm-hmm. And that may be, again, a more of a cultural decision.
Right, and that's what...
Because we want to see these guys sit there and struggle and pull and push, and being that they're physical comedy actors, I mean, we want to see them... beat on each other and everything else.
Yeah, but it really didn't even add to that.
You're right. It just seemed like
it was just
went on.
Yeah, it was just repetition.
And then at the end, they get to the top and say, oh, here's...
Oh,
we could have gone to taking the shortcut.
Yeah.
And the same thing going down the hill the same way, yeah.
So, Scott, is that just more me being a stupid American, or...?
Some of that is just the style at the time where... If you had guys who were physical comedians, you gave them room to mug and mess around. And some of it is just a Japanese sensibility of longer takes, more sedate pace to a lot of their fiction.
That's fair.
Yeah. You're paying for a movie, so you want to see a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was not afraid of making a long movie.
No.
That's for sure.
In fact, it's sometimes a little too ambitious in many cases.
Hmm. What's hilarious is he's not afraid of making a long movie, but he was afraid of making very talky movies. Like, it's a shame you guys didn't review any of his Shakespeare adaptations.
Well, yeah.
Because those are, you know, some excellent pieces.
Right, that's a Throne of Blood and Ron.
She doesn't preserve any of Shakespeare's dialogue, but the characters are still very much there.
Now, what are those adapted from?
Macbeth.
You've got Throne of Blood, which was based on Macbeth,
mm-hmm.
with Mifune playing playing the Scotsman in question.
Okay.
And then there's Ron, which is based on King Lear.
Okay.
And, like, Lear has some of Shakespeare's best, you know, speeches in it. And you don't really miss that in Ron, because there's just the way it's shot and the way the characters emote convey that exact same feeling.
Gotcha.
Also, the witch characters in Throne of Blood are just way creepier in compared to Shakespeare's. there's not a lot of rhyming.
Nice.
And you get right to the point.
All right, well, what else do you guys have? Because I think I blew my proverbial load earlier.
Okay, well, getting back to the plot of this movie, after the showdown between the generals, you have the princess communing with the peasants in that bonfire festival.
Yes.
Which is movie is about conflict between the classes,
mm-hmm.
and the princess gaining an understanding of who she actually rules. So it's a really big deal when you get to the end, and she's singing the song again.
Yeah.
Which feels like it's way too long again, but it's very important. Like, she's sort of got the spirit of her people with her now.
No, you know what? It was one of those things that when they were doing the dance, I thought the dance went on too long. But when she goes back and sings the song, I was very comfortable with the fact that she sang the whole song. Because it was like, she heard it once, and she sat through that. I mean, it wasn't like it was overly repetitious. It was a set of lyrics, and then she just regurgitated them and sang them. And I thought that was
with
really
a lot
cool.
of feeling too.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just here are the words of the song. I mean, she sang them and kind of owned it.
Yeah, and then the peasants get their one Rio, which sounds really really bad, but that's like. That's like 4,000 silver coins.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds like, oh, this is a pittance, thank you for your help, and it's one more kick to these lowly peasant characters. But it's like, no, that's a big pile of money.
Yeah.
Well, also, too, it's the last scene when they're walking down the stairs, and they're trying to say, well, yeah, why don't you hold it? And suddenly, these two have, after they've been through all of this, have finally just resolved all these conflicts. They no longer mistrust each other. So in the end, they did kind of win out because mm-hmm. they did get something out of this whole thing they can take back. And they've also got a little stronger friendship now.
They also, I mean, it seemed to be that they were better off than they were at the beginning, which is all they really wanted,
mm-hmm.
whether it be one Ryu or 200.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right. I mean, well, they're going to come home with something if they can make it home.
Right.
But we now know that they're not going to kill each other on the way there, at least until they get out of town.
Well, and considering how they were acting as they left, I mean, their fighting and their bickering is what kept getting them into trouble.
Mm-hmm. And now they've got to the point they can trust each other.
Right. So you were saying, Scott?
No, that was my point, is that, okay. You know, a Rio's quite a lot of money.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Adam made the point that it's...
It's about a month's rice ration. When you consider a rice ration at the time was about a 50-pound bag.
Right.
So that's quite a... That's going to get you through a lot. I mean, you come home, you could buy... with what they got, I looked up what a Rio is. It's 165 grams of gold. So translate that into ounces today. They're carrying a lot of cash. enough to get them home and probably get them reestablished again.
Nice.
At least for them, anyway. Yeah. It's a lot of cash. Probably more than they'll ever see in their lives. And they live to, and they and they get, they actually get to live to spend it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the other thing. Is, you know, you get the impression they'll actually survive this time.
Well, yes, if they can stop bickering and work together.
Yeah, I liked that soft ending for them. That, you know, we didn't get complete resolution. That they made it home and everything's happy, but you kind of feel like, okay, this is enough of the story. You know, you can extrapolate from where we leave it that everything's fine for them. Or they can have another adventure.
Or they could get captured yet again.
And we could have a sequel. Oh, wait, no. This wasn't made in the Hollywood system.
Yeah, well, Kurosawa did do sequels every now and again.
Yeah, that's true. He did a sequel to Yojimbo.
And he always wanted to do a Godzilla movie.
Really?
Yeah.
That would have been interesting.
I would have loved to seen that.
Yes, a Godzilla movie with Akira Kurosawa as the director and writer. That would have been quite fascinating.
And Mifune would have played the monster.
Mifune would have been the monster. Yeah, absolutely. Just not makeup.
Just no makeup. Just him rising out of the ocean, yeah. Breathing fire.
Oh, that would have been fantastic.
Yeah, but I think Toho realized it's like, no. As cheap as Godzilla movies are to make, Kurosawa would find a way to go three times his budget, no problem.
Yeah, no kidding.
But it would still be the best Godzilla movie ever made. It would be at least legendary.
Yeah. Better than Godzilla versus Megalon?
Or even Mechagodzilla?
Oh, but Godzilla versus Megalon had Jet Jaguar, the robot that could program himself to do anything. Including get bigger, because that's how computer science works.
That's right. Programs always expand, and so do robots to fill the available storage capacities and budget.
All right, I think with that, I'm done. Mm-hmm. You guys got anything else?
If part of your film education should be at least this movie.
Yeah.
In addition to several others, but you should put this one on your recommended viewing list at least once in your life to at least just appreciate it.
You know, before we started this little venture, I had not seen any Kurosawa movies. I'm enjoying every one of them,
mm-hmm.
And I'm likely going to watch more of them as I get time.
Yeah. And I think Criterion put this one out in a nice little box set with Yojimbo, Sanjuro, and Seven Samurai a while back. And so if you can get that box, it's actually pretty affordable, considering that it's four Criterion movies.
Yeah. Well,
but that does come with some additional commentary and whatnot, right?
Yeah, but since that box set, they've released even bigger, more deluxe-ish versions of those four movies.
One of the nice things is if you have Hulu Plus available, the Criterion Collection is on Hulu Plus. That's how I've been watching these
movies.
Same
here.
And unfortunately, Kajimusha is not part of that. It's not on Hulu Plus, but right now it is on Netflix.
Right.
So it is true. So for those listening who want to catch up on it before we talk about it next time, it is available on Netflix.
And that one is a very different movie than any of the others.
Again, it's another one I have not seen, so I will check it out for next time.
Now I'm trying to remember which one Kagemusha was. Okay, more.
That was the body double.
Yeah, that was the body double one.
Shadow Warrior is mm-hmm. what it was subtitled. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw.
Taking over the rule of this killed warlord.
Yeah. So it's Dave.
Yeah, it's exactly like Dave. A light-hearted comedy romp with many amusing misunderstandings.
That's what I gather. That's what I'm going into it expecting.
Mm. We'll say it's a more serious Dave.
Yeah. Yeah. I did note that that one of the genres on Netflix was that it was dark.
Mm-hmm.
So, not so much Dave.
Dave not known for its darkness.
No, it is not. All right. Well, thank you, Scott, for coming in and schooling us on many things Mifune and Kurosawa.
It does add to the discussion.
Yep. Yeah. It's always good to have one of the other backseat producers come on to the main show and drop some knowledge.
Well, and I did not do this just so that I could greatly expand my running time relative to Chibi's. Not that I'm jealous of him at all.
Of course not.
You have a lot of catching up to do with after his Pixar episode.
Yeah, I know. That. Well, I think his total is like 7 or 8 hours mostly between Pixar and The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, but it's he's also done a few others, but those two alone, it is a steep hill to climb.
It is.
So, and thank you for your continued work on Backseat Quickies. For anybody who's not listening, they should check it out because your longest one's been 15 minutes long?
14 minutes.
Ah.
But that's without the intro and outro.
Right, right, right.
I normally only pay attention to the time on the raw recording.
Yeah, and I listened to the Roderick Rules one. I listened to that just today. Actually, I've gotten to the point where I put them in the feed and then I listen to them. Like,
are you sure that's smart considering my bad habits about muting the main?
I have actually one of my checklist items for the files I get from you. Check the audio.
Is it actually there, or did he screw it up? I figured out why it happened. Is that when I go to record the episode number whatever the beginning, rather than offsetting it, I'll just mute the main one and then forget to unmute it. So when it encodes the main topic,
have we ever done that before?
We've never done that before. We have not recorded before.
Yes, we forget to hit the record button.
That's happened, which is far more tragic because we can't just make that back up.
No, that
or,
was...
or unmute it and re-encode it. So, yeah. But yeah, and why don't you tell the folks how they can participate, Scott?
Okay, yes. As much as Tony thanks me for my continued work, you could do some of the work for me and make my life a little easier.
And by you, you're not talking about me. You're talking about the listeners.
Yes, I mean the listeners.
That's right.
There are basically anyone can record a little, I guess, 4 to 14 minute audio file about a movie that they have seen. And there are numerous ways you can do this. You can use the Backseat Producers voicemail line, which has the call me button, so you don't have to pay for long distance.
Yep.
You can leave a voicemail on my Skype, or you could record your own file via that.
Whatever.
Like, you can download Audacity for yourself, it's free.
Or by whatever recording.
Or you could
use
Windows Sound Recorder. Mm-hmm. And you could just record that and send it to me at my email address.
Cell phones allow you to voice record, too.
Your iPhone has a built-in recorder. And so probably Android has a built-in basic recorder.
Yeah, in fact, on Backseat Box Office last week, we released the first ever Backseat Box Office UK, which was recorded by Tom, who just happens to live in the UK. And he recorded it on his phone. He just
dictated
it right into his phone through the voice recorder in his phone. Worked beautifully.
So you email that to me, and I will do all the other stuff. Can't promise I'll totally do the editing for IQ points, but I'll get at least just some of that in.
The people, we're looking for raw.
We'll bump you
for raw, fast, and dirty.
Right.
We promise 3 to 10% IQ point upgrade. That's percent, not points.
Yeah.
We can't fix complete mental breakdown.
Yeah. And then you can send that in, and I will post it, and then you too can be a backseat producer.
Woohoo!
Yes.
More the merrier.
And less work for all of us.
Right.
Yes. And a measure of internet fame for you.
Yes.
Booyah.
Yes.
You can also include a promo for anything you feel like at the end of the episode, and I'll make sure that stays in. So, great way to get some free advertising.
There you go.
Your plugs are included.
for your art, your writing, your
girlfriend,
whatever you want to sell. There you go. Yeah, if you want to put a shout out to your significant other,
yes,
for their birthday or for an anniversary. I'm just
makes
talking
mounds
now.
Of Julian fries.
Yeah. You can also use this format to disagree with any of us about anything. If you just want to send in a file with point form notes about how the many different ways David has been wrong, you can do that.
Yeah, it would not be surprising if we get like a 3 hour long backseat quickie at a Chibi for our analysis of Kurosawa. I am fully expecting it.
That could
we
happen.
Hope. We could edit that into 3 or 4 episodes. Less work for us.
That's a series. It's a 12-part series of quickies, because we'll break those down into 14-minute chunks.
That's right. Hey, that's an entire month's worth of production here.
That's like 3 months.
Okay, it's even better. It's like you could take a break for 3 months and do something else.
Take a quarter off, Scott.
I could. And something I'm going to be doing soon, I'm going to tweak the quickie format around a little, and I'm going to do the occasional top 5 list.
Oh, nice.
Around a certain theme. So, like, I think the first week of December, you're going to hear my top 5 favorite Christmas movies of all time.
Mm.
Fantastic.
And you can definitely throw your top 5s in for that.
Yeah, that'd be great. You know what? That's a great call out for the listeners to throw in their top 5s. Maybe we could just do a series of top 5 Christmas movies from various people throughout the month of December.
Yep.
Hint, hint.
And you can take the opposite approach. The 5 worst Christmas films
that
should not be viewed by anybody. At least they damage their psyches.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and you can get more information about participating. If you couldn't make sense of what we were saying, or if you were driving and you want more information, go to the forums at spookyouthouse.com. Click forums, then click Backseat Producers. There's a thread in there where Scott lines out the ways that you can contact him to produce your own quickie and be part of the Backseat Producers.
That's right. This is a community effort, and we need your input.
Yes.
All right. We will see you guys next time with I'm assuming I'm saying this wrong because you guys are pronouncing it different than I am.
Katamusha?
Kagemusha?
Kagemusha?
Yeah.
Okay.
No hard G's in Japanese.
Kagemusha. Okay. Musha. Kagemusha. I'm making an effort to pronounce it correctly.
All right.
All right. See you guys next time.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks, Scott.
Good night.
Good night.
See you.